Good morning. How are we all doing? Excellent. We've avoided mass panic for now, I hope. No, some disagreement. There are people involved with mass panic. All right. It is a difficult, trying time, whether because of the panic or because of the pandemic, but we do have in mind those who have been caught up in this one way or other. It's a difficult time. We hope it passes. I'm sure many of you either have or have friends or family who have Pesach plans and feel like it's up in the air and you don't know what to do. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yep. I've got family who's meant to be coming in and I'm getting WhatsApp every 3 seconds. Not that I can do anything about it, but thank you for letting me know. And please God, this will quiet down and we will restore to normal. Now, Parashat Tetzaveh is in some ways a continuation of last week. Last week we set up the Mishkan, we spoke about the vessels, the kelim, and this week we turn to the vestments, or which again is one of those words you only know if you've read the Oscar translation of the Chumash. Who says vestment? Nobody says. Do they?
Yeah.
How often?
Twice a day.
Twice a day. Oh my gosh, wow. Okay, so that's more than us. So only Catholics and Jews who have read the Old Scroll know the word vestment. we also call it clothing. Big day kuhuna. There is a little bit about one of the vessels at the end. I'm touching my face. But one of the korban. How aware are you when you're touching your face now that we do it all the time? There was an amusing clip. I guess it wasn't meant to be that amusing, I don't know, yesterday of the president sitting with the health professionals saying you shouldn't touch your face. And he said, I haven't touched my face in weeks. It's unbelievable.
And he said, I miss it.
He said, I miss it. Yeah, I don't know what to make of that. But, you know, we say strange things in the moment when we're on camera or being recorded. Come on in. Help yourselves. Okay. So I distracted myself by touching my face. What was I talking about? So this week we turn to the clothing. There's a little bit at the end about, as I said, one of the mizbechot, one of the altars. That's toward the end. Otherwise, the parasha is made up of essentially two sections: the clothing of the kohanim toward the beginning, and then we transition into korbanot, sacrifices, the inauguration of kohanim, and how that functions ritually. So, but there is one piece right at the beginning where there are two things worth noting. The opening pasuk. Anyone know what the first two words of the parasha are? Ata tetzaveh. Who's Ata? And you. Who's the second person? Moshe. Moshe is not often referred to in the second person, which of course is why this parasha is marked as the only parasha since Moshe's birth in which what? His name is not mentioned. He comes up in the narrative, he's instructed in the very first word, Va'ata, God is speaking to Moses, but his name is not mentioned. Now, what are we to make of that? It can't be purely incidental. His name comes up all the time. Why is it not mentioned in this parasha?
Later on, it says, to race me,
is that what you were going to say too?
About the
right, so there is this tradition that in the context of the golden calf, Moses says to God, if you destroy this people, basically over my dead body. He says, erase me out of the book. I want nothing to do with this. Because God says, I'll get rid of all of them and I'll turn you into a great nation. What a great deal. You know, you're the rabbi congregation. It gets a little bit rustly. People are making a lot of noise, a lot of complaints. Say, how about I make you the rabbi of the best synagogue in the world? I give you a huge salary. You don't have to speak to anybody. And I'll get rid of all the congregation. I obviously would say no. But I can imagine some of my peers saying, I'll go for it. And Moshe says, no way. This is not about me. This has never been about me. If this was all about me, Moshe says, what would I have done? I would have stayed in Midian. I wouldn't have gone to Egypt. I wouldn't have taken all this on board. He said, this is not about me. The people needs to be preserved. Erase me from your book. And there is a rabbinic tradition that if a sage, if a scholar, if a prophet makes a curse It is so powerful. It has such, welcome back. It has such weight to it that merely the utterance can't dissipate. Having uttered a curse, it needs to come to fruition in some form, which is why the Talmud all over the place suggests that sages be very careful with their words. You say something, it comes to fruition, even if it has to be channeled in a different way. So Moses says, erase me from your book. And in order for that to kind of come to fruition in some way, retroactively, his name is left out of this parsha. That's one, it's kind of a mystical reading. The Midrasha notes that as well. But there are other readings to why Moshe's name is left off. The Vilna Gaon suggests actually almost every time we read Parsha Tetzaveh, it coincides with the calendar with a specific date. Anyone know what date was 2 days ago? Zayin Adar, the 7th of Adar. What happened on the 7th of Adar? Moshe passed away and not in that order, right? Moshe was born and he passed away. It was a significant moment where he entered the world, but also where he left the world. And in recognition of that absence, his name is left off. So we should feel very conscious of the loss of what's missing in our lives. That's what the Vilna Gaon suggests, his name's missing, to kind of coincide with that absence in the calendar. That's his suggestion. But Rabbi Sacks has a piece he wrote either last year or 2 years ago, suggesting, actually, why does Moshe's name get left off? Who's the front figure in this parasha when we describe the clothing of the Kohen Gadol? Aaron, his brother. And he suggests this is the first time in the biblical narrative, in biblical history, in which siblings seem to get on, know how to make room for each other. And here Moshe says, this is about Aaron, this is about the Kohen Gadol. I'm going to step back. We're talking about him. And he's able to step out of the scene, and that's why his name's not in the parsha. That's a suggestion that Rabbi Sacks has as well. Now, that's the first observation we make about the opening of the parsha. Moshe's name isn't in it. But the second thing is that the first instruction has nothing to do with clothing. What is the first instruction of this week's parsha? Atah tetzaveh b'nei Yisrael v'yikru eilecha shemen zayit zach ketit lema'or. That's helpful. I didn't realize I knew that pasuk off by heart, so that was helpful. That you shall be commanded to take for you shemen zayit zach, pure crushed oil, ketit, pulverized, lema'or. I don't know if ketit is really, I mean, it means like squished. Lema'or for the light. Nothing to do with clothing. It's about preparing for lighting the menorah. And there are a couple of observations made. Shemen zayit zach, v'yikru eilecha, you shall take to you. The Midrash suggests actually there is a metaphor being played out here. That you are being instructed not just to physically gather these olives to make oil for the menorah, but you should, v'yikru eilecha, you should take for yourself as a model. Shemen zayit zach, pure olive oil. You should all behave like oil. Now, how does oil behave?
Pure.
Okay, so one should be pure. There is actually an explosion of Midrash here about the way that oil is procured, the way that olives behave, the way that oil behaves in terms of how Israel should behave. In some ways which are uplifting, in some ways which are terrifying. Anyone ever seen olives being harvested? Harvested being a loosely. Yeah, how do they harvest oils? So they shake them. Even shaking them off the tree sounds gentle for what I've seen them do. They have, well, I say they, whoever harvests olives, have these big, meaning it would take a while to get up a ladder and to pluck olives off a tree. So they have these big nets they put around the bottom of a tree, and they take this huge, it looks like a rake, but it's like bigger and wider and broader and harder than a rake, and they basically smash the tree until the olives fall down. And the Medrash at one point says that's essentially Jewish history in a nutshell, or in an olive tree, I guess, that we get smashed and beaten and persecuted and exiled and pogromed and burnt and just hurled through the globe. But it's to procure the purity of olives. I don't know if that makes us feel better, but there is an association here that there is, say again? No, it doesn't, right? That there is a hint in the ritual of the menorah in terms of how we procure purity. And again, it's a theology of pain and suffering, in which when we're faced by pain and suffering, it's very hard to come to terms with it. How do you justify pain in the world? One option is to say, I can't justify pain. And that can lead one down a road of theological difficulty, where if I can't justify pain, I don't understand how to justify God. Maybe I'll just live with it. But there is another way to think about this, which is to say that pain is actually, I'm not asking why. I only ask, what is it for? What does it teach me? What can I do? How does it sensitize me? Rabbi Soloveitchik has a somewhat well-known essay where he suggests that we don't ask why when things happen. We just ask what now? Because when it, I can't answer the question. I don't know why things happen. But all I can say is, now that it's happened, what's my responsibility? And I know I can only speak in the minor struggles that I've had in my life, that when something happens, you, one way to come to terms with it is, okay, now that I've been through that, I understand other people who are going through that or will go through that. It just sensitizes me in a way that hopefully makes me a more sensitive, more moral, more attuned, more empathetic person. And the suggestion is that we get beaten to provide, to procure that purity. Again, the whole Exodus from Egypt, for some, it's premised on the fact that we went there to sensitize us to the pain of what it means to be alien, what it means to be oppressed, what it means to be chained. That's the whole explanation of why we go down to Egypt. We'll get to the Haggadah, I'm sure, in more detail as we get to Pesach. But there is a one of the commentaries. Anyone got the Malbim Haggadah? Anyone heard of the Malbim Haggadah?
I'm sure you have it.
Actually, I don't. But I'll tell you why. Because it's a farce. It's a farce? I don't know how you say it. It's a fake. Fake news. It's printed in English. I think maybe Feldheim or Oswald put it out. It's called the Malbim Haggadah. In Hebrew, it's called, anyone know what it's called in Hebrew? Midrash Haggadah. And it says Hamalbim. But in very small letters, it says Al Derech. Hamalbim. Which means in the style of the Malbim. It wasn't him, it was somebody else who felt that the Malbim style was obviously compelling because he was the most important Jew that ever lived. But so he felt like there's no Haggadah, let's do a Malbim style Haggadah. And he uses his method in his commentary to try and build up a Haggadah. Either way, one of the points he makes along the way is, hold on a minute, we're all sitting around, we're saying, this is a miracle. This is amazing. God came down and he saved us from Egypt. God smote the empire. He got rid of Pharaoh. He brought down plagues. He split the sea. This is worthy of celebration. But hold on a minute. What else did God do? He put us there in the first place. We're sitting around saying, God, you could have saved us a lot of trouble. And you could have saved yourself a lot of trouble doing all these miracles and plagues. Just don't send us down there. Don't make Yaakov go down. Don't make Yosef go down. Keep us all. What was this all about? And one of the, there are a whole slew of suggestions as to what the diaspora in Egypt was meant to achieve. But one reading is it was to sensitize us to the pain of other people. And as a nation that was to be the moral exemplars of humanity, how could we do that without having empathy, without having experienced what it means to be in pain? And that aligns with that midrash about the olives, that actually you need to be battered around as olives in order to procure that sense of purity. Again, some people are going to like that, some people are not. There's another way to deal with pain in the world, which in fact Maimonides seems to endorse the Rambam, which is that God created a material world in which there is pain. That's the only way we can exist as material beings. That's the only way we can have responsibility as material beings, is that we live in a world where things decay and things go wrong and there's pain. And again, in the context of where we are right now with the coronavirus, I saw, how many of you on Facebook? All right, those who are not, you may be healthier for it, I guess. But I saw yesterday one of the rabbis in New York City posted a piece, said, I remember last time there was something that affected the modern Orthodox community more than the other parts of the Jewish community, and people came out and started saying, oh, it's because they're not as sanua, they're not as modest in the modern Orthodox, or because they don't daven, they talk during daven, whatever it is. And he wrote, if I hear the very first person to say this, I'm going to come after you, and it won't be pretty. He wrote that. Again, you have to be in the rabbinate a while to be able to post something like that on Facebook. It was Rabbi Robinson, yes. Rabbi Shaul Robinson from Lincoln Square. He said, the very first person who says, I'm coming after you, and it won't be pretty. And he's actually, he's been a strong advocate of people not attacking each other, which is a reasonable thing to be an advocate for. Somebody came out against a rabbi from an out-of-town community. I can't remember which one it was. They were a young Israel. And they changed the name for some reason. I can't remember what it was. They stopped being a young Israel for some reason. And a whole bunch of people launched an assault on him. Ad hominem attacks, like, oh, he doesn't come to davening on time. And Rabbi Robinson responded and said, okay, let me be clear. I'm a rabbi. I'm very often late for davening. And all sorts of things. And if you're going after him, you're going to come after me as well. I don't know if they did go after him. I'm not always on, strictly speaking, on time to davening either, so you can add me to the list. But either way. So in this context, when people are looking for explanations for why things happen, why is there this virus? What is it warning us about? What is God trying to tell us? Some people try to find reasons. One suggestion, again, in line with this, is just that we can't answer why. All we can do is say, what can I take from it? Which is sensitivity, trying to bring people together, try to be as transparent as possible, try to keep people informed. It should sensitize us to the condition of other people's lives and try to help us heal each other. Now, that's one way of reading the olive oil. There's another way the Midrash says that what olive oil in particular does, which is the Midrash says, Cholam ashkim ba'olam, all the liquids in the world, if you put them in a, what's the official term for a zhuzha? A zhuzha. You put it in a thing, which? Immersa. Today, I'd forgotten to mention, today's shiur is sponsored in honor of the yahrzeit of? Your father. His neshama should... Moshe? Ben Yaakov's faith. Neshama should have an aliyah, and all our learning should be in his merit and his memory. So, if you put them in a zhuzha, all the liquids in the world, you get a nice cocktail, you get a, whatever they call it, a milkshake, it all gets mixed together. You put oil in a zhuzha with anything, you give it 3 seconds, what happens? Whoomp, the oil rises to the top. And the Midrash says, Kasha osim ratzono shel makom, when the Jewish people perform the will of God like oil, they float to the top, and when they're not like ratzono shel makom, they're not like oil, and they fall down to the bottom. How does that resonate with you? What do you feel that Midrash is suggesting?
Jews are great.
Jews are great, or Jews? Jews can be great. So what does that mean? Meaning when we're performing the will of God, the suggestion of that Midrash is what? That we're on top. What does that mean we're on top? This is going to be read and received differently by different people. Not what?
We're a moral people, basically.
Okay, so meaning, if you permit me to try to kind of unpack what I presume is your assumption, if somebody else can scratch my nose, that would be very helpful. What are we meant to do for weeks?
Take a tissue.
It's not that bad. It's just an impulse.
We're not on top of it, we're rising.
Right, so let's unpack this, right? Oh, forget it. Let's unpack this. What Diane was wrestling with is, hold on, you're trying to say that we rise to the top. You're trying to say that essentially, that existentially, Jews are better? It almost has...
We should be better.
Right, so that...
We're the chosen people. We should be better, not that to say we are better. You know?
Right, so this is what we're straddling with, is that there is a promise that if we fulfill the will of God, we're the best, we're on top. It's almost like we're standing on top of other people. It's a very strange thing. Why don't other nations, why don't other peoples have the capacity to rise up? Why is it that we have that power? And one solution, we could just step back and say, okay, first resolution, it's not what we'd call PC, is that we were chosen by God, we rise to the top, that's just the way it works. Jews have, and again, this is somewhat controversial, but there have been views through Jewish history that suggest that the Jewish soul is somehow empowered to be closer to God through the election of the people, and we rise up when we follow God's will, and that is a very insular way of looking at Jewish life. That really, the rest of the world isn't that important. They should, you know, have God in their lives, but it's not really our business. Our job is to work on us. We live inside our world, and we try to rise up, and because we were chosen, because we have the Torah, because we have the history of a relationship with God, we're empowered to rise to the top. That's one view. It's controversial in the modern context to some degree, because what it's saying basically is, that there is racial preference for Jewish people. You can convert in, but the rest of humanity is almost, you're not as good. I'm sorry, nothing you can do. That's one reading. The suggestion here is that actually...
We should show the way for others. It's not only us, but the rest of the world.
Right, so one way to mitigate that...
It's only me, I can only be me, but it's for the rest of the people to see that we're good. You
know, that's great.
And they're doing the right thing.
That's great.
But the social justice way.
Right, that's great. There's one way...
Not that she has an agenda.
No agenda. One way to mitigate or to... re-emphasize that is to say, when it says when Jews fulfill the word of God, they rise up. Really, the Jew is just emblematic of the servant of God. When we talk about the Jew, we're talking about people who follow God. The challenge some people have is that almost dilutes the force of the statement, but it's making a claim that when you follow the will of God, you rise up. That following a life of faith gives you more power, it makes you spiritually elevate in all sorts of ways. There is an interesting way I've seen this being read, is that when oil floats to the top, it's not just that it floats on top of other things, but it does something else for those things. If you, it separates out. So that's also, I guess, on some level an interesting tension here about integration with other nations. But there's something else that it does. If you put a nail, I had to do this in high school, chemistry or physics, something to do with science. You put a nail in water and you leave it there for a week. What happens to it? It starts to rust. You put a nail in water and oil on top and you leave it there for a week. What happens? It protects it. If you leave water on the side for a week, it goes stale. You put oil on top of it, it doesn't go stale. It insulates it from the corrosive elements of the atmosphere. And I've read the suggestion that Jews, when they're doing the will of God, it's not, oh, when you're doing the will of God, you will be rewarded by floating to the top. But when you are doing the will of God, you will be doing this. You will be insulating the world from the corrosive effects of all the things that are in the culture and in the atmosphere. That you're doing the will of God means to rise on top. Yes, we're not going to get around the hierarchy. There is a moral superiority to Jewish life. That has to be the basic claim of Jewish life. Not that other people are inherently inferior, but that Jewish life is a superior way to live. Otherwise, what are we doing? Why are we doing this? God told us to, that's true. Presumably God told us to not as a big prank or a joke, but because he thought this was the most redeeming way for people to live their lives. So there is a sense of moral superiority, not that we are better inherently, but that Jewish life calls us to live better lives. And by doing that, and trying to exemplify that for other people, we insulate the world from the corrosive effects of the human impulse and instincts and urges. That's another reading of that midrash. Now, okay, so we've done the midrash on the first half of the first pasuk. Now, yeah.
I have a technical question.
Great.
Is the ner, tamid, a separate item from the menorah, and why is this the way of the shemen? Here with the Ner Tamid rather than last week's parsha with the menorah, which is where it was used primarily.
Excellent. So you remind me that despite me being proud that I got the Pasuk of by heart right, I didn't. I forgot the last few words. That it has to be ketit lema'or la'alot ner tamid. That it has to be crushed lema'or to light in order to ignite the eternal light, the Ner Tamid. Where's the Ner Tamid? Over there. This is a minhag in shuls, almost universally, I think, to have a ner tamid. And then the question is, what is a ner tamid?
It says where it is. It says, the Olam Moed puts up the Rochet al Asher al Ha'idut.
Which is where the menorah was in that area. So the question is, was the ner tamid something separate, or is this remembering the menorah? And what does tamid mean, the translation of the word tamid?
Constant.
Constant. Was the menorah lit all the time?
No.
No. How long was it lit? Mi'erev ad boker, from night, from dusk till dawn, whatever the case is, right? It was not lit. What is Ner Tamid? The Ramban, Nachmanides, suggests that actually one of the candles was lit all the time. The most western light was lit all the time. Everyone presumes it's talking about the menorah, not a separate thing, and different ways of resolving what Tamid means. Tamid might mean not constantly, but regularly, every single night it was lit. So it meant it wasn't always lit all the time, but every night it was lit. That's one way of reading Tamid. Why is the oil here as opposed to somewhere else? Good question. I don't have an answer for that, why it's here as opposed to there. It is worth pointing out that the oil had to be used in the Mikdash in other contexts. When else was the oil used? For the menorah, it was used to light. It was used for the Kohanim in what context? For anointment. It was on their earlobes and their fingers. Where else is oil used in the Mikdash? Korbanot. Which Korbanot?
Mixing with the flour.
Right, the Minchot. They had oil and lavender and flour and frankincense and other things, I assume, that I've never seen or smelled in them. Oil is used there. And it's pointed out that here, Shemen Zai Zach Ketit Lema'or, crushed for light, Chazal read as being a different standard of crushed. It has to be even purer. When you go to buy olive oil in the stores, or you order online and they deliver the wrong one to your house the next day, how do you deal with that? Every week they deliver the wrong stuff. And you call them and you say, why are you delivering the wrong stuff? And they say, so don't order from us. Oh, okay, I've lost all my leverage. I guess I'll carry on ordering. Either way, you order different kinds of oil. There's extra virgin olive oil, there's virgin olive oil, which is essentially to do with the sediment presence in the oil, how pure it is. And the assumption here is that for the light of the menorah, it had to be ketit l'ma'or, even more pure, which is what Rashi cites from the Midrash, which is different to ketit l'menachot. There it had to have no sediment in, but the olive oil, how would you get olive oil for the menorah? How would you crush it?
It's pressed.
How would you press it? You put it in a press. So this is astonishing. The way that Rashi renders it is that actually you wouldn't press it and then take the oil, because at that point, once you've pressed it, there's some sediment in it. You would very, very gently squeeze an olive until a few drops come off that have no sediment in. The olive is still intact, and you put that aside for the menorah, and the rest of it goes for the mincha. And each olive, it's just a few drops, the most pure drops that have no sediment, no taints, no corruption. They're unsullied entirely. It's astonishing how pure it has to be. And I could ask you why the menorah has to be so pure as opposed to anything else. Why does the mincha not have to have the purest olive oil, but the menorah does? Because Hashem said so. Okay, so let's move on. When God speaks, or when Linda speaks, we move on. One could say that, what's the function? What's the function of the oil when it comes to menorah as opposed to the function in the mincha? In the mincha, it's an ingredient, right? Purity isn't that key. It's about flavor. When it comes to the menorah, what's the function of the oil?
Light.
The purer it is, the brighter the light will be, which then breeds a whole question about when the menorah is the function of the menorah. What is the function of the menorah? To have light, what is that light doing? Okay, so this is the fascinating question. Does it have a physical function, or is it a symbol? There is one view that suggests that the menorah essentially is a sideshow. It's a spotlight to ignite what's opposite the menorah. Which, anyone know what was opposite the menorah in the Mishkan? The shulchan, the showbread. It was essentially just a spotlight, a lamp to light up the bread opposite it. There's a completely different view that, no, it's nothing to do with light, and it's actually all about the symbol. And it was designed precisely in a way that it would be clear that it was not meant to emit light. How was it structured so it would not emit light?
In a row.
It was in a row, and which way were the wicks facing?
Inward.
They were all facing as inward as possible to indicate, if I wanted to give off light, I would spread the wicks out, I'd point them out. This is about internal light, it's a symbol about light not being needed in the Mishkan. And there was another part of the Bet Mikdash that showed that light was not needed in the Mikdash. Anyone know what I'm talking about? Windows. If anyone's ever seen Robin Hood or any other medieval castle in a movie, the windows tend not to be wide open vistas, because if you're in a castle and you're looking for defenses and you have big open windows, what gets in? Anything, right? Arrows, catapults, soldiers, enemies, whatever gets in. In the old world, you didn't have glass. Instead of a big open window, it was a real statement of a vulnerability. So they'd often have windows structured in a way that you could kind of fire arrows out of without being hit. But the other advantage of having a window that narrows towards the outside is that it captures the light and it diffuses it inwards. And it gets the space to be as light as possible. The Bet Mikdash was designed with it narrow on the inside and it opens outwards, which is the opposite of serving the needs of the Bet Mikdash. It would make the light dim inside. And the suggestion there, the Rabbeinu Bachya and others, is that the statement symbolically being made by Solomon, who made that design, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who makes the design of the menorah, is that the Bet Mikdash is not about harnessing the light of the world and channeling it to itself. It is not a narcissistic enterprise. It's not an egotistic enterprise. It is about giving light off to the world, not giving it in, bringing it into itself. Okay, so that's the first pasuk. So we deal with... Oh, that wasn't even the pasuk we were putting under pressure. Either way, we have the oil in the first few pasukim, and then we have all the clothing. And I want to focus on one piece of clothing in particular. How many pieces of clothing did the high priest wear, the Kohen Gadol? He had eight. The regular Kohen would have four. And they are astonishing in their details. And I want to look at one in particular, the Choshen HaMishpat. What was the Choshen HaMishpat? The breastplate HaMishpat of... Justice. The breastplate of justice. What does that mean?
Sounds like
something from Superman, right? Meaning it sounds pretty powerful and impressive. What does it do? What was it for? And there are all sorts of explanations for what this was used for. What was the Choshen used for?
Well, they covered.
Say again?
They covered to the tribes. It had the stones of all the tribes.
Okay, so it captured the tribes with different... So this is a good point. What was it made of? Let's begin. Now... We often talk about the Choshen or the breastplate when it comes to a Sefer Torah. So many of us imagine the breastplate was kind of this solid silver thing with gems in it. Anyone know what it was actually made of? It was made of fabric. It was a woven thing with gems in it that folded in half and had the Urim V'Tumim inside. It was not a big weighty thing. It was made of fabric. You can look on Wikipedia. They don't have a picture, a photo of it. They've got an illustration. It was made of fabric. You look in the art scroll. It was a fabric that was folded in half. It had gold rings in the corners that held it in place. And it had these 12 stones in it. Now, it was Mishpat in this context. Doesn't necessarily mean justice, but actually is often rendered as judgment. It was the breastplate of judgment. It was used for consultation. And it would give judgments on matters. What would it give judgments on? So the most limited reading is it was for military purposes. This was not a kind of solve all, you've got an issue, come and ask the Choshen. It was not an oracle, like in the old Greek context, where you went to ask whatever you want and it gives you feedback. This was a consultation device for the things that are most inscrutable in human life. Should we go to war? Should we not go to war? I need to know what to do with troops, life and death. And it would be used in that context. And how would it give its message? Would it speak? So it had the names of the tribes engraved on each of the 12 stones, and there is a tradition that the letters would light up, and you would have to get the message out of the letters. Now, would they light up in order of the word?
No.
How do we know?
Because they confuse words. They confuse the letters to make different words.
Right. So there's the... I guess the prime location where this happens in tradition is when Chana is praying the Bet Mikdash. Right at the beginning of the book of Shmuel, there's a young lady called Chana who has not had any children. She has a co-wife to her husband. Anyone know the co-wife's name?
Penina.
Penina has how many children?
A lot.
She has 10 children. And Chana's sitting there. She's got no children. She's upset. And Penina says to her, her husband says to her, I know Penina's got 10 children, but am I not better to you than 10 children? I love you. I'm here, your husband. At which point, yeah. So it's read as a level of insensitivity on the part of the husband who can't really appreciate the difference between spousal love and maternal love. And she's desperate for a child. She goes to the Bet Mikdash, where the high priest at the time is Eli HaKohen. And she sits on the floor and she's mumbling. And what does Eli say? In the biblical text, in the book of Shmuel, it says, get out of here, you drunkard. What are you sitting going on the temple? Get out. And we've all seen people davening that we imagine could do with a breathalyzer. And here they go, what are you doing? Get out of the Bet Mikdash. That's all the biblical text says. And then she says, I'm praying. I'm not drunk. I'm praying to God. Which again, Chazal suggests means that the high priest had not seen somebody praying. And he didn't recognize what prayer looked like. People weren't praying very much at the time. This was a debased culture, civilization at the bottom of where it could be, where the high priest himself doesn't think that the population can pray and is struck when a woman comes in and is muttering on the floor. In the temple, the idea that she might be praying doesn't seem to come to mind. Chazal, however, suggests that it wasn't just his instinct, but there was some information coming his way that said that what she was doing was problematic. He was wearing the choshen, and the letters lit up, and four letters came out. Right. It came out, Sin, Chaf, Resh, Hey, which spells Shikra, drunkard. He says, drunkard, get out. But if you mix the letters around, you get Kshera. Again, why would you put it in the wrong order? I don't know how you make that decision. I guess it's ambiguous to the point where even the reader and the receiver of messages is given the freedom to make a judgment. And he settled on that judgment, which was incorrect at the time. Now, the Choshen Mishpat was used as a consultation device, but in addition to that, we've got a few minutes left. All these objects, and I'll talk about this more on Shabbat morning, it's very strange. It seems very cultish. When about 3 years ago, there was a Intelligence Squared debate. Anyone familiar with the Intelligence Squared debates? It might be a British thing. You can YouTube it. They have celebrities, professors, politicians come and debate, take one side of an issue. The most watched one are always about Israel and the Middle East, but they have ones that are less, I guess, famous or controversial. There was one that was quite controversial about, is the Catholic Church a force for good? And they had one politician and an archbishop suggesting that it was a force for good. And they had two public intellectuals who were more from the group that's been called the New Atheists who came along to say that it was not a force for good. And one of the positions taken, and it's interesting to watch these things, and they take a measure of where everybody stands on the issue when they come in the audience, and then when they stood on the way out to see how much the audience shifted during the debate. And one of these arguments made by the New Atheist was, let me take for granted for a moment, let me assume that faith is a good thing. Let me assume that it makes people more moral, and it makes people more given, and it makes people more charitable, and it makes people more empathetic. Let me assume that for a moment. He might say, I disagree, but let me assume that. Having said that, is the Catholic Church a force for good? And he said, unquestionably no. And he said, not only is it not, but the founder of that whole movement, a couple thousand years ago, would be ashamed of what they're doing. He went around preaching giving to the poor, about living modestly. And he says, go to Vatican City, and what do you have? You have a temple laced with gold and gems and jewels and these big staffs and hats and jewelry. He says, you're hoarding the world's riches for the sake of your own power. That's not charitable. That's not a force for good. That's not promoting charity or modesty or morality or care. That was his argument. And in some ways, the argument could be made here. We've come out of Egypt, a cultish world that worshipped gold and idols. And we come out, and the first thing we do after we get the Torah, God tells us, okay, build a temple, get the gold, get the purple thread, dress up in this uniform that is gilded and bejeweled. And one could say, hold, didn't we just get away from this? Aren't we trying to build a society based on morals, not on the market? What is happening? Which is a reasonable question. Of course, there are answers. And one of the answers that Chazal suggests is that actually in this same parasha, we have the clothing and then the sacrifices to suggest that they have a similar function to atone. There is a atonement metaphysically, pedagogically performed by these items of clothing. When the high priest wears the choshen, it is not just an aesthetic point. It's atoning for something. On the page that you have, second box, the Gemara in Zvachim says, Amr ben Anani bar Sason. Anani bar Sason said, Lama nismecha parshat korbanot leparshat bigdei kahuna. Why are the sacrifices juxtaposed to the clothes? Lo malach to tell you, ma korbanot mechaprim af bigdei kahuna mechaprim. Just as there is an atonement performed by sacrifices, which again, you might think, oh, well, that's intuitive. What are the clothes doing? It's not that intuitive that I kill an animal and I throw its innards on a platform that my sins are expiated. That's not an intuitive thing. We just trained that that's how it was done, so we're used to that. But in the same way that putting korbanot on the altar atoned for sins, the kohanim wearing the clothes atoned for sins. And then it details what each one of the big day kohanim atoned for. And you had the bells and the pomegranates around the hem atoned for what? What did the bells atone for? Lashon Hara, the kind of reverberating sound of the high priest's hems, would atone for Lashon Hara. And Choshen Mechaper Al Hadinim. And the breastplate of Mishpat would atone for din, for dinim, for judgment. What's the sin of judgment?
Wrong judgment.
So one assumption is for its incorrect convictions or wrong judgments. Courts make mistakes all the time. Rulings and verdicts get overturned all the time, either through reason or evidence. I think we've had in the last couple of years a whole spate of overturnings, of overturned verdicts because of DNA evidence. People who've been convicted on murder or other things, and then the DNA evidence proves that they were elsewhere or that it was someone else, and they get overturned. That happens. Again, I can't remember the name of the movie. It was about 15 years ago. My mother was watching and I saw part of it where somebody staged that they had killed somebody, even though they hadn't, and they'd videoed that they hadn't, to prove that the system of capital punishment was unjust, and they ended up, they had some terminal disease. So they said, I'm going to die anyway, I want to die in a way that's meaningful. So he set up a system where he'd be sent to death row and executed, and then as a result, his friend would release a video showing that he didn't do it. So he purposefully put up a poor defense in court to show that in America, you can get convicted and killed incorrectly, to show that capital punishment's wrong. Anyone know what I'm talking about?
No.
I can't remember what it was called. I seem to remember it being Kevin Spacey in it. So it was a while ago, but you can look it up in your own time. Either way, courts make mistakes. They're fallible. And here there's an assumption the Choshen Mishpat atones for that fallibility. Now, how? You could say it's like korbanot. I don't know. It's some metaphysical, esoteric system where you wear it and somehow things go well in the universe. That's one suggestion. And the more mystically inclined will accept that. There is another reading with which we'll finish, which is Yakeda Yitzchak, Rabbi Isaac Arama, who I've mentioned in passing a couple times. He lived in Italy, whose son accused the Abarbanel of taking all the Akedat Yitzchak stuff and putting it in a more accessible way. And the Akedat Yitzchak, he wrote what's called drashot. Oh, maybe I didn't mention this. In his introduction, he says, why did I publish? He's got maybe two drashot on each parsha. They're very philosophically complex, and they're very thorny, very hard to read. Rabbi Munk put out a translation of Isaac Arama's drashos, but it's not a direct translation because they're so thorny. He basically summarizes and makes it more accessible. And Rabbi Arama says in his introduction, why am I doing this? Why am I putting out some philosophically complex drashos? Is that what the Jewish people need? And he said, yes. People keep coming up to me in Italy and saying, we're forced to go to churches in some districts. And when I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, I wish I wasn't here, I can't sit through this again, the priest gets up and he gives a sermon. And you know what? It's not theologically resonant for me because it's a different faith, but it's impressive. It's sophisticated. It's inspiring. It's uplifting. It's public pedagogy. And when I go to shul, what do I get? I get a little drasha about something that, you know, doesn't really resonate. It's not that impressive. It doesn't lift me. I need something sophisticated and compelling and engaging. Rabbi Rama writes, so that's why I'm producing this. So they shouldn't think that the church has a monopoly on sophisticated thought. Judaism is what birthed that other faith. We have wealth as well. And he writes these sophisticated drasha. And in one of them, he claims that there are four principles of judicial life. If any of you were ever asked to speak at the graduating class of, there's no school that trains judges, right? They just train lawyers. You can't go anywhere to train to be a judge, right? Correct. Right. So imagine that the first year of those who've been appointed judges get together for their annual dinner, the judge dinner, and you're asked to be the guest speaker. Rabbi Arama would say there are four principles of judicial integrity, and they are said by us every week on Tuesday morning after Shacharis. It was written by King David in the 82nd chapter of Psalms in Tehillim Pei Bet, and we say it's the Shir Shal Yom of Tuesday. And in it, there are four principles of integrity that judges have to abide by. And this is in the middle of your sheet. We're skipping the Kliyakar. Tehillim Pei Bet. Mizmor La'asaf. Elohim Nitzav Badat Kel Bekerev Elohim Yishbot. The judges are in the presence of God, and he judges in the presence of judges. Now that's a complicated verse, because Elohim is being used to describe both God and the judges. So you have to, different ways to resolve which one's who. But either way, God is in the court, is how this begins. We say this every Tuesday. Shir Shal Yom, say Hayom Yom Shlishi B'Shabbos, Hayom Reis HaMikdash. And then we say, Mizmol Asiv, Elohim Nitzav Badat El Bekerevim Yishbat. Four rules that David calls out that judges need to heed. Number one, Ad Matai Tishbetu Avel. Until when will you judge iniquity or badly? Ufnei Rishaim Tisusela, and will you favor the faces of the wicked? Principle number one, do not favor the wicked. Why would someone favor the wicked or the guilty party? For what reason would a judge favor someone who's guilty?
Bribe,
let's say. Right? Meaning, don't favor somebody because they're wealthy, or they bribed you, or they look to you like they're more my kind of person. Whatever the case is, number one, you need to have a conscience when you're a judge. And we're going to have three C's and an H. And if you can think of what the fourth word would be with a C, that would be very helpful for the pattern. Number one, conscience. You need to have a conscience when you're a judge. Do not favor those who are wealthy or elite. Number one. Number two, Shiftu Dalviyatom. Judge the downtrodden and the orphan, Anivarashat Stiku, and give a verdict for the poor and the destitute. Second reason he says maybe a judge might err is by saying, I want to be a famous judge. I want to feel like I had my training to deal with big cases. I want to oversee impeachments of presidents. I want to deal with crimes on the scale of billions of dollars. I want to deal with the O.J. Simpson trial. I want to be at the forefront of what it means to be a judge. I want everyone to know my name. I want to run a show, which I think is coming to the end of syndication this week, right? Judge Judy, after 25 years, this was not meant to be a dig at Judge Judy. It just happened to coincide with the news. But I want to be the judge at the forefront of what it means to live judicial life. Someone comes and knocks, I got a parking ticket, I'd like to get off, and you're sitting there, I went to law school. I want to be a judge. I tell people, I have my life invested in the legal system, and I spend my day sitting here dealing with parking tickets. I could not be less excited about my job. Any of you ever been on jury duty? Have you all been called for jury duty? Oh, all right. Well, I guess I'll await my summons. Do they call people who have immigrated and become citizens?
If you vote.
All right. That's another incentive not to vote. All right. Is that really how they judge it? I've registered already. All right, so they'll get me. That's how they get your name. So it's interesting. It works differently here than in the UK. Here you get called to be part of a jury pool, and then they pick, right? And lawyers get a certain amount of dismissals. And also, in England, I think you get called, and they're just 12. You're just called, and you're the jury. That's it. And there are certain exclusions in England. If you're a doctor or a lawyer, you don't get called. Is that no longer the case in England? Oh, here. Right, well, they decided that doctors and lawyers, why would you limit people who are thoughtful and have done research and know the law from being in the jury pool? Doctors, I think their assumption was they have patients who may get ill and need a doctor. But either way, I think they changed that rule in England as well. Now, when you're summoned on a jury, sometimes you think, all right, well, if I have to be on a jury, I want it to be an exciting case. I want it to be a murder trial. I want it to be something dramatic. I'd rather it was a parking ticket and I could just be done. Interesting. Okay, I'll bear that in mind if I ever get called for jury duty. But the assumption here is that, let's say you're a judge and that's your job, and you're not being taken away from anything else. You want a bit of dramatic flair. You want legal sophistication and nuance. You want to be able to deal with these things. And again, not because you have a desperation or a sadistic will for people to be in dramatic circumstances, but because you get to solve some of the big critical issues of the day. This Olympics doctor who's now in jail, To be the judge on that case in some ways is a dream, not because, oh, I get to see all these people who suffer, but because I get to bring justice down upon this person who's been found guilty of these horrific crimes. And here the instruction is, shiftu dalviato. If you're a judge, you don't need to just have a conscience, you need to have conviction that everybody deserves justice. This is not just about the headlines, this is not about you, this is not about you having a syndicated show, this is not about you solving the world's problems, this is about you dealing with someone who is in need of justice. And if someone walks in and said, I've been given a 50 buck fine and it's going to bankrupt my family, and you think, oh, you know, I've got to deal with this, I say, yes, you have to deal with this. It is your job to solve society's ills at every level, and you have to judge whether they are billionaire, scandalous doctors or football players, or whether they're people dealing with parking tickets. It is your job, and you should be just as inspired. So number one, you've got to have a conscience. Number two, you've got to have conviction that justice is needed and required for everybody. Number three, paltu dalve evyon, rescue the downtrodden and the destitute, miyadresha imhat silu, save them from the wicked. Now, this is number three, and the three, third C is courage. You need to have courage to be a judge. Why do you need courage? To do the right thing. But what might you be scared of? Retribution, right? I'm sure, again, many of you have seen these movies where judges turn the ignition in their car and it explodes and witnesses get chased down and whatever it is. And it is, to me, again, the last 3 years have been politically incredibly tense globally. Maybe in America, especially in Britain, I'm sure, as well, with Brexit. There have been high-profile witnesses in Congress. There have been impeachment proceedings. And to me, putting aside which side one stands on, one of the most impressive things is that we live in a country in a time where you have the most powerful man in the world being opposed by people without power, and nobody is getting shot. Nobody's getting assassinated. Nobody's getting killed. People are hoping that the system will work, however it works. But you go back 500 years, if someone stood up to power, out you go. And maybe I'm naive. Maybe this still happens on some level. But it was, as a witness to the unfolding of political life, it was one of the most impressive things that we live in an age and a time where you can have the battles of the most powerful people. Someone who has the button for Diet Cokes on their desk, but also the button for the nuclear warheads on their desk, and says, and doesn't have somebody assassinated. And again, we think, why would that happen? But that's what happened all the time in a world where we didn't have the rule of law. And the suggestion is here that when you're a judge, you are not just sitting there solving issues, you're on the front lines, and you have to have courage. You may be killed. When you're a judge, in England, they wear wigs. Now they wear wigs because it's silly. They used to wear wigs because they tried to have some level of anonymity for the judge. My grandfather was a magistrate. You have magistrates here? So it's a low-level, entry-level judge where you don't have to be a lawyer. I can't remember. You have to do a certain training course, and it's a low-level court where you deal with things like parking tickets and things like that. You do a training course, you get accredited, and you become a magistrate. And when he retired and he wanted to do some different things, he wanted to do a magistrate. My mother may have done the course, actually, now that I think about it, too. Either way, so he had one case where somebody came with a parking ticket. And 3 days later, he went out for dinner at a restaurant, and he was looking at the menu, and the waiter came up to him and said, "Hello, judge, what do you want?" He said, "Oh, okay. Well, I'm going to get something in my soup when I order it." Right? And obviously that's low stakes. But that's why they wore wigs, so that you wouldn't be recognized because of repercussion. Again, spit in the soup is not the end of the world. Maybe with the virus going around, it might be an issue. But the idea that judges live cushy lives, or should aim to live cushy lives, or think of their lives in luxurious terms, is being pushed back against in this third principle of judicial integrity, which is you have to understand that even if it means you sit there and you think, I'm at risk, there are people, and again, 50 years ago, when there were mob cases being adjudicated, maybe this is still being adjudicated in the New York system, when you're a judge and you're sitting there potentially putting a mobster away, you don't think to yourself, I'll go home and I'll be fine. You have worries. You have concerns. You may want to recuse yourself. And even if you're not corrupt and you say, I'll let him off, you may say, you know what? I don't want any of this. I'm going to go back to the parking ticket court and I'll just deal with that. I don't need this kind of controversy and risk in my life. And here you're being told that actually as a judge, you're like a soldier. You're on the front line. You're not saving lives, but you're keeping the world just. And that has its risks. And he actually, the Ikeda Yitzchak, has a long piece where he says, this is basically, you're putting your life in sakana for the sake of justice in society. And that is the third principle of integrity. Number four, lo yadu v'lo yavinu b'sheicha yitalachu. Sometimes judges err, not because they have a lack of conscience or conviction or courage, but because they have a lack of humility. You think, oh, I've heard this case, I've heard this before, I know the answer, here's the answer. And actually, sometimes judges have to know when they don't know. And this is generally true of everybody. I'm sure that rabbis have this temptation. People ask him a question and you don't want to look silly, or you just say, oh, yeah, and you haven't looked into it. I'm sure doctors have this pressure as well. Someone comes with something and you think, I'm not entirely sure, but I don't want to look like I'm incompetent to my patient. And judges and doctors and rabbis and parents should also feel, a lot of the times my three-year-old will ask me questions that I don't really know the answer to, and I could just make something up, or I could say, I don't know. And it's hard sometimes. It's not that hard to say to my three-year-old, I don't know. And sometimes that's the easiest way out of a conversation. But it's hard to say, I don't know. And judges are impelled to say, with a level of integrity, I don't know. So that's, we have enough conscience, conviction, courage, and humility. If you can think of a C for humility or knowing your limits, you can add that. But those are the four principles. Now, why do I mention that? Because he says all four of these principles of integrity are embodied in the Choshen. It is not just an item that achieves metaphysical atonement. It is a manifest tool of pedagogy. It is teaching judges how to behave. That's how it atones for bad judgment, not in somehow it corrects all the bad verdicts, but it is an instruction for how judges should behave. That's how it atones for bad judgments, by teaching judges how to judge. Number one, you've got to have a sense of conscience, that I don't favor the wicked, I don't favor the rich or the wealthy. Everyone's equal. How does this show that everybody's equal? The Choshen, number one, he says, what order were the sons in? What order are the names on? Age. Birth order. It's not about who is most important. It's not about who achieved the most spiritual life. It doesn't take into account who was given curses by their father. Pure, there's no hierarchy. It's just birth order. That's number one, he says. Number two, how do I know that you should take cases even if they're not the most high profile? What kind of stones were used on the Choshen? So, again, I always in my mind assumed we're talking about precious gems. But actually, there is a mixture. There are some precious gems and some that you'll find outside in a parking lot. There are some little average stones you can find, clumps of earth basically anywhere. And then there's the sapphires. And the idea is that he says that you shouldn't think, oh, well, I only have sapphires and emeralds and topaz and I don't have any of this common stuff. But actually, the stones were a mixture of precious and non-precious stones to show that in justice, you don't favor the precious or the gems. You think about the cases of the parking ticket cases. Every case needs to be adjudicated, number two. Number three, how do I convince myself that I need to go out on a limb, even if it means risking my life? And he says, because God's name is engraved on the Urim V'Tumim. They tell the Kodesh Baruch Hu's in charge. That really, you have an obligation to serve the will of God. This is not you preserving yourself on your plinth as the judge. You have to have conscience, you have to have conviction, you have to have courage that God, you're doing the will of God, number three. And number four, the Urim V'Tumim, as we said, were a consultation device. Inbuilt into this system is that there are things that you do not know, that you need to consult, that you need to reach out for guidance and counsel. And in that way, this simple breastplate that seems on its surface to be a very strange signal of aesthetics and wealth is actually a pedagogical tool for how judges should adjudicate cases with a sense of conscience and conviction and courage and humility. And we'll leave that there for the Parsha Tetzaveh. Next week, Parsha Ki Tisah, we have the golden calf, all sorts of issues. Please God, this situation will contain itself. We are sending regular updates. As it stands, nothing has been cancelled. And in the meantime, I wish you all a healthy and restful Shabbos ahead.